This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, a look at life along the U.S.-Mexico border. But first, media scholar and MIT professor Sherry Turkle has spent 30 years studying the psychology of our relationship with technology. In her book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, she shows how a flight from conversation undermines our relationships, creativity, and productivity, and why reclaiming face-to-face conversation can help us regain lost ground. I recently talked with Sherry Turkle about the importance of conversation in our digital world. Sherry, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thanks to technology, Sherry, we're more connected than we've ever been. So how is it that something that seems to be a good thing, how is it affecting us in a negative way?
Well, this book, Reclaiming Conversation, is very pro-technology. It's not anti-technology, it's pro-conversation. So what I mean by that is you have to be more intentional in your use of technology. So if you put a phone on a table between you and the person you're having lunch with, that phone, all the studies show, is going to deteriorate the quality of the lunchtime conversation, and it's going to decrease the investment, the degree of empathy that the two people have who are having lunch together. If you redo the experiment and you put the phone on the periphery of the landscape, you'll have the same effect. So the problem isn't the device. It's that even a silent phone disconnects us from conversations that matter. And when I interview college students and I talk to them about their practices with their phones, they say to me things like, you know, the problem isn't our texting. It's what texting is doing to our face-to-face conversations when we're together. That's the problem. They do something they call the rule of three when they go out to dinner with their phones, which is that they sit around a table, and if three of their heads are up, if three heads are up out of six, they feel permission to look down at their phone and ignore the other people at the table and start to text or go on social media. And what happens to the conversations as I listen to them demonstrably is that they become more superficial, and again, they become on things that where you can interrupt someone. So what's happening in these conversations is that people aren't learning, once again, the skills of empathy, the skills of paying attention to another person, of getting to know and respect another person. And this is the work that we need conversation to do. So that's the thrust of my book, that we're getting into connection, but we're losing conversation.
So if I understand you correctly, it's not so much the device as the way we're using the device.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Use your device when you're not around other people.
Now, what kind of research went into this book, Sherry?
Well, it began with comments that were made at the end of Alone Together, where particularly college students and young professionals said to me things like, I'd rather text than talk. I'd rather text than talk. And I decided, as a psychologist, that if they really meant it, I'd rather text than talk, this would have tremendous implications for their professional lives when they began life in the workplace. If 19, 20, and 21-year-olds were then beginning their graduate school lives and their work lives, really preferring to text than talk. So I began this particular book by going into law firms and companies and graduate schools and looking at what this meant in romance. I studied couples and people dating, and so it began with the world of I would say millennials as they began relationships and work, and then I went back and as I saw the extent of the problem, I decided to do a developmental book and went back and studied children and families and the conversations of growing up and the conversations of intimacy. So the book really ended up with many, many hundreds of interviews and many hundreds of visits to companies and, you know, workplaces, a snapshot, an ethnographic snapshot of conversation in America.
You've been studying this issue for about 30 years. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So
I've been studying digital culture for over 30 years.
Yeah. Well, what got you started in the first place? Was it the first personal computer that popped up?
I took a first job at MIT, and I saw things I'd never seen before. I saw people who looked at a computer and who saw it as, I called it, a second self, who because the machine was a kind of psychological machine, it was a machine that had an almost mind, it didn't have a mind, it had an almost mind, saw it as a psychological device and projected their feelings onto it, saw it as something that was almost alive, and I just thought this is a fantastic subject for psychological investigation.
So a second self, almost like an alternate identity, is what they were
yes.
saying.
Yes, yes. And then I've just followed the story, and my feelings about it have changed. I mean, I would have to say that in the beginning, I found psychologists, you know, particularly my colleagues, humanistic psychologists, were very hostile to computers. And I was trying to say, hey, listen, there's something like really fantastically interesting here. Don't be hostile. Look at this new phenomenon. It was a place where people were exploring identity. They were going online. They were playing games. They were creating avatars. It was really interesting. I was really, I don't want to say I was a proponent, but I was trying to point out in several books that this was really a, you know, something that everyone should be interested in from a psychological point of view. And then I met some technologies that caused me to have great concern, and two of them are the backbone of reclaiming conversation, the two that concern me, and one is what I call always on you technology, which is the technology where we ignore each other because we always have our phones at the ready. I like to say that our phones make us three promises. You know, that we can always be heard, we can put our attention wherever we want it to be, and we'll never be bored. And that is so seductive that it causes us to just stop our conversations. You know, in the middle of a conversation with somebody, we're gone. And that is in fact very destructive, both to grown-ups and to your work and to your love life, and most of all to your children as they're growing up. That particular move. And then the other technology that upsets me very much is artificial intelligence, robotics, computer agents that pretend they have feelings for you. I was just interviewed for a New York Times article on a doll called Hello Barbie that comes out of the box and it says, "Hello, I'm Barbie. I have sisters. I have a sister. I'm jealous of her. Do you have a sister? Are you jealous of your sister? Let's talk about how we're jealous of our sister." I mean, she pretends she has a life. And I've studied technologies like these, and they're extremely, I would go so far as to say, toxic to children when children start to get into as-if pretend relationships with objects that pretend to have human lives but don't have human lives.
What kind of a reaction have you gotten to the message from your book, Reclaiming Conversation?
I think people are ready to hear this message. I think it's a tough message, but I think as soon as they realize that I'm not saying I'd like to take away your phone, they realize that they know many of the things I'm saying they know by heart, and they just need to find a way to implement it in their life. I mean, I think that we've come to a point. It used to be that I like to say that we were like young lovers who didn't want to talk too much for fear that talking would spoil the romance. And now we're ready to talk. And I think that that's where we are. I think it's kind of like a silent spring moment that, you know, we're ready to see that there's an assault on empathy, and it's no good for us. It's no good for our kids. It's not so great for productivity. And we need to bring conversation back into our workplaces and into our relationships with our children. And it's just hard to make those first steps. But we really have everything we need. We have each other. So the reaction I've gotten is, well, do I have to give up my phone? No. You just have to use it with more intention. Oh, well, then, okay, maybe. Yeah, let's talk. So I want to start a conversation about this. That's my goal. I want to start a conversation.
I'm talking with Sherry Turkle, author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. And Sherry, you sometimes hear people say that in this digital age, we don't have privacy anymore. Do you agree, disagree with that? How big of a factor is privacy in this?
Oh, I write a good deal about privacy. Privacy has many, there are many parts to this. I write about how when I was a little girl, my grandmother would take me to the public library, and she would emphasize how the books that I took out of the public library were my private business, because in democracy, it was so important that I had private mind space, to think whatever I wanted to think, to read whatever I wanted to read, and that nobody could ever know what I was thinking and reading, and that was really important that I grow up with that feeling. And of course, she was coming out of a totalitarian background in Europe, and to her, this was the miracle of America. And so a world where everybody knows what you're reading, and you share everything you're reading, you know, is a world where we are losing something that other generations of Americans knew to be terribly precious. I mean, I remember during the Clarence Thomas hearings when Anita Hill said, well, you know, when her lawyers were saying, well, let's look at his video store records and let's see if he rents pornography. And then his lawyer said, "No, it's just like library books; they should be private." And he won on that argument. I remember my grandma. I wanted to see those records, but I remember my grandmother would have been pleased that he had a right to the privacy of what he took out of the video store. And we're giving that up. And I think that there too, there needs to be a new reckoning of just because we have a technology that enables us to see everybody's record doesn't mean that should be part of the terms of agreement. And I think I'm hoping, again, I want to be part of the conversation that goes back to first principles and says, do we want to have a life that's transparent? That doesn't have to be part of the deal. And we've kind of backed into it as though it had to be part of the deal. It does not have to be part of the deal.
So can we balance our connectivity with our privacy? Is it possible to do that?
It is possible to do that. At the moment, we're not making the baby steps of effort. It's just, you know, we're not making the baby steps of effort, and then we say, well, our children don't care. And this to me is the thing that makes no sense. I mean, if the grown-ups don't make I'm calling it the baby steps of effort, and just kind of sign on to services and allow services to develop that don't protect our privacy at all, seem to forget the entire, you know, civil libertarian tradition that led us to protect our privacy so fiercely and for such good reason, such good historical reason. And then we give our children apps that don't protect their privacy at all, and we have these children grow up with apps like that. And then we turn to them, then we turn to each other and say, oh, our children don't care about privacy. It's on us. It's on us that we grew them up in a culture that seemed to not care about it. I grew up in a culture that cared a lot about privacy.
Sure,
because my parents valued that. So, I mean, in all of these things, it's not too late. There are laws that have not been written. It's not too late to walk this back and to create the digital culture that we can live in that will create a more democratic and a more protected society. I'm optimistic. I don't think we've addressed this yet.
Now, let's talk about some of the specific areas where technology is affecting our relationship. For instance, how is this affecting the educational system?
Well, my chapter in Reclaiming Conversation, I have I think what's going to be a very controversial chapter on education, because one of my big points is about unitasking. Unitasking, which is doing one thing at a fancy way to say doing one thing at a time. And, you know, students come to college almost incapable of doing one thing at a time. I mean, they've grown up in a life of windows. They've grown up in a life of, you know, doing seven or eight things at a time. And Multitasking is a very neurologically dangerous thing, because when you multitask, and follow me here, you think you're doing better and better at each task you add, but actually you're doing worse and worse for every task you add. So your brain tricks you into thinking you're doing better and better, kind of giving you a master of the universe feeling, as you're doing worse and worse. So when you come in, you ask students, well, how are you doing now? You're doing seven things now. No, 5 minutes ago, you're doing six. They say, oh, better. And actually, their grades are falling down in each of the things they're doing. So the more you multitask, the more you want to multitask, and the more your productivity, you know, is in the toilet. So we have to teach our students to not do this thing that makes them feel so good, because they simply can't do their work productively if they continue to do it. So that's like the first educational, I would say that's the first job for educational systems, starting with kindergarten, is to get students who live a life of windows and screens and multiple screens to just do one thing at a time. And also to be able to turn off the Wi-Fi and to just focus on one thing. And then, of course, I have a lot to say about computers in classrooms, where I think that everyone's experience is showing more and more that when you're in a classroom, having your laptop or phone or tablet open at the same time is doing nobody a favor.
Well, what kind of effect has this had on public discourse, the public square, politics?
Well, you know, research shows that people who post online want to post things that their followers will like. So there's a kind of spiral of silence that follows from the world of posting. It doesn't have to be that way. And there are examples where individuals don't make it that way, where they, you know, open their minds and hearts to other people's ideas. But most people are looking for those likes. We live in a culture of likes. And they're chasing those likes. And so the spiral of silence is where people end up posting more and more and reading more and more in the circle of things they already know. And a great English essayist, politician, journalist named Addison wrote in the 18th century that he used to go to the English coffee houses, which some people think of as the seat of English democracy, because he loved to talk to people whose opinions he disagreed with. And I think that online we risk talking to people whose opinions we agree with. People make a big fuss about the newspaper of me, you know, kind of creating, you know, you go through and you check the parts of the newspaper you want to read, and you check the columnists you want to read, and you check the things you want. And in the end, you know, like Addison, maybe it's better to be more exposed to the things we don't want to read. And that experience of going through the library and meeting ideas we never heard of, and books and opinions we never knew about, or opening a newspaper and having our eyes fall on all kinds of things that irritated us, and people who listening to ideas we don't know. You know, I think that we're narrowing rather than widening. It's not a simple story of what the internet does. We have a lot of ideas about what the internet was supposed to do that it turns out in practice we're not letting it do.
So what advice do you have? How do people go about reclaiming conversation? What are some of the things they can do?
Well, my first advice is, first of all, is to set aside three places in your home, in your life as a family, let's say. I start with the kitchen, the dining room, and the car, and say these are device-free places. And what's important about these is that teenagers, I would say 14 up, will often, because they're so used to going to a device, they'll say, I don't know what to do. I have nothing to do. I don't know what to do. Because they're not used to going to their imaginations. In the car, you can play car games with them. You can get them talking. In the kitchen, the dining room, you can give them tasks. You can say, we're cooking. Here's the recipe. You can start to give them things to do so you don't get that kind of sullen, I don't know what to do reaction back. And in these places, they're just for talking. And if you get pushback, you simply say, this is how our family culture works. So you start with creating sacred spaces for conversation, and you can do that in your workplace as well. You know, conversation, you know, casual Thursdays can become conversational Fridays, and you begin to just make these spaces for conversation. Secondly, you start to think of unitasking as the next big thing. It's one of the most important, I just can't stress enough how important that is for productivity. And conversation is good for the bottom line. In the project I'm going to be focusing on next, I'm going to be trying to bring this message to business. I mean, conversation is crucial to productivity. And in my chapters on business and reclaiming conversation, I do case studies of businesses that theoretically know this, but they make their workers stay online and on the messaging system all day, so nobody feels that they have a moment for conversation because they're on the messaging system all day emailing. So we have to, you know, really make conversation part of our business life, make productive time off from being always on your phone part of what you offer to employees, and mean it. You know, create a business culture that has conversation in it. And this has to start at the top, or nobody will believe that you mean it. If your device is, if you're in a family situation and your device is making you take your eyes off your, is keeping you from keeping eye contact with your children, you know, think with intention and put away your phone. Your children really need you. I interviewed one father who remembers fondly how he used to give his daughter a bath when she was 2 years old, and she's 11 now, and now he has a new 2-year-old, and he just does his email on his iPhone when she takes a bath. And, you know, my lesson from interviews like that, and I did many interviews like that, is try to follow what you know by heart in terms of bringing conversation back into your life. And my last piece of advice really is that you have to recapture solitude. Reclaiming solitude is often the first step for reclaiming conversation, that if you don't teach your children to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. You have to be able to tolerate solitude and enjoy solitude in order to then have conversations with other people in which you just don't, you know, pretend that they're saying what you need them to say in order to make you feel better. So you need to begin with solitude and then move out to conversations with other people. But you need to learn to spend some time alone without your phone and without feeling so antsy that you don't have your phone, and it kind of makes you crazy.
Sherry, thanks so much for talking to me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Media scholar and MIT professor Sherry Turkle, her new book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age.